Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan has the night off, and I'm pleased to have veteran homicide prosecutor Donna Pendergast co-hosting with me tonight. Donna, welcome back to Crime Wire.
Always glad to be here, Denny.
And we have a little glitch to start off with tonight. Our first guest has not called in yet. I don't know if there's an issue or not, but I'd like to take advantage, Donna, of your expertise to talk about some cases that have been on my mind and get your take on them. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
First of all, since the last time you and I talked, of course, Johan Vandersloot of Natalie Holloway fame was arrested for murder, where was it, Peru or someplace, and got a lengthy sentence there. Now, I understand they're considering extraditing him back to the United States for trying to defraud the Holloway family. And I've heard pros and cons on that. I've heard some experts say, look, leave the guy where he is. He's doing harder time there than he would here. And just let him go and drop it. Others are saying, oh, no, he needs to be held accountable for what he did, even if not the homicide or the murder of Natalie, at least for what he did to the family and put them through. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, wearing your prosecutor's hat, is extraditing Vandersloot a good move or a bad move?
Well, frankly, Denny, it's an expensive move. And, you know, looking at all the factors, what we, you know, possibly could gain from extraditing him back, as opposed to what we could lose is a lot of money. But that being said, you know, I know Natalie's family is heck-bent on getting some measure of justice. And if it's not for a murder case, you know, I know victims, and I've encountered victims many, many times over the years that they get to a certain point where they basically say, we'll take anything. And I'm sure that's how they're feeling. And quite frankly, I think that should factor heavily into the equation. But, you know, if he's going to do more hard time in a much worse environment, my prosecutor gut instinct says, why do we want to spend all the money to bring him here? But my victim advocate hat, which, you know, obviously sides with the family, says, well, bring him on. You know, let's bring him on and let's try and get some measure of justice. But frankly, I'd like to see him rot in a Dutch prison.
Yes. I got to tell you, I was really hooked on this case when it was, you know, during the disappearance and when everything first broke. And I felt so bad for Mrs. Holloway, you know, all those trips to Aruba and then thinking there was progress made. And, of course, I don't really understand the law in Aruba. You know, it's obviously a lot different than it is here. But at times you thought, hey, they got a break, they arrested somebody and blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, they can only hold them for X number of hours or days and then they're out. And so I don't know. And I wasn't convinced, Donna, I'd like your opinion on this. Do you think the police did a slam-bang job on this investigation? I was under the impression, and I could be wrong, but my feeling was they could have done more or done it better.
You know, there's always the critics out there who are going to say the police could have done it better and they could have done more. And, you know, watching from afar and, you know, hindsight is 20/20, perhaps they could have. But I got to tell you, I think for the most part, at least here in America, most police officials, they try to do the right thing, and they do the best that they can do with the resources that they have. And over again, you know, despite working long hours for little pay and, you know, sacrificing their personal lives to try and do the right thing, they walk into a, you know, through the doors of the courtroom, and over again they are criticized for what they should have done, what they could have done, by people who have really no knowledge of what their constraints are, what their resources are. You know, it's a tough, you know, a tough thing to swallow when you sacrifice your personal life on a daily basis and, you know, all you do is get met with criticism. You should have done this. You should have done this better. Perhaps they could have, but I think most people that are willing to work as government servants and take the pay that comes along with that, they do it for a sense of personal satisfaction. And I think most of these people, you know, like every field, there's a few bad apples, but I think, you know, they try to do the right thing because for the most part, they're in it for the right reasons. So shoulda, coulda, woulda, yeah, as a prosecutor, I get frustrated frequently thinking, God, why didn't they do this or why didn't they do that? But then I try and put the other hat on like, hey, you know, they were working, you know, 18 straight hours at this point. And, you know, it's just, you know, I'm a police fan. I'm very loath to criticize the police. And, you know, that, you know, even extends to police in other countries.
Yeah, and I share that. And I'm quite sure we're pretty much in agreement that probably the vast majority of the law enforcement people are in it for the right reason. They want to do a good job. They try to do a good job. Like you say, you get a bad apple here or there. Maybe you get somebody that, for one reason or another, got through the screening process, and maybe they really weren't cut out to be a police officer. Maybe they have some shortcomings. They're not intentional things, but maybe they just aren't quite up to it. But I think what makes me the most angry of anything is when you get the actual crooked cops. Remember the mafia cops, they called them, what, Eppolito and the other guy that were doing hits for the mob? Yeah, I just don't, that just blows my mind.
You're the mob guy, Daddy.
That's right. They probably work for some friends of mine at one point. But those guys, you know, when they actually go on the pad or become criminals themselves, rather than, you know, laziness or incompetence or whatever. That really, and I would suspect that maybe as, you know, someone involved in the criminal justice system, you might share that feeling, too, about actual criminal cops.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've run into a few circumstances over the course of my career where, you know, you are dealing with a profoundly bad apple, and, you know, that's so very disappointing, not only being in law enforcement myself, but because of the taint or the tarnish that rubs off on, you know, so many other police officers out there, you know, that work so hard for so little money. You know, during the course of the time I was a prosecutor in Wayne County, Michigan, which is where Detroit is, and I was only in Detroit 3 years. However, those 3 years, I did more murder cases, well, maybe not more, but nearly as many as I had done in the 14 years before in a neighboring county. Unfortunately, two of those murder cases that I did in 3 years were police officers that were killed in the line of duty, which are always very tumultuous, you know, cases that just rip the heart out of the law enforcement community. And I did two within the span of a year, which, you know, even for Detroit, that just was an extraordinarily bad streak of luck. And, you know, to see the brotherhood and to see the police officers in there and to, you know, feel, you know, just, you know, the love for their brother and you know, the gain some measure of understanding, even more so than I ever had as a prosecutor, of, you know, what their daily lives are like. You know, my opening and my closing arguments, I really had to put myself into the shoes of a police officer and, you know, make arguments that drove it home to the jury, like, you know, a cop, you know, their daily life is, while the rest of us on holidays and everything else are enjoying the holidays, they're out there. Their families are suffering. And, you know, every day, every step they take, they know that, you know, is the end of their life. I mean, the end of their life could lay around the next corner. And, you know, in my opening and closing arguments, you know, I had to convey to the jury, it's like, this is their life on a daily basis. And, you know, and then I remember in one opening statement or closing argument, I guess it was, you know, I was just talking about a police officer's daily routine and always knowing that it could come from any angle, you know, and then I just stopped and I looked at the jury and I said, and I still remember the defendant's name, I said, and then one day you meet a Tony Townsend. No time to decide not to put yourself in harm's way. The danger becomes real in a moment. And, you know, I could see the jurors, their eyes were wide as saucers. And, you know, later a couple police officers came up to me and hugged me and said, you know, we were just sobbing during your closing because, you know, you drove home what we go through on a daily basis. And so that's why I always try to give police officers the benefit of the doubt. And when you do get a bad apple who, you know, puts some taint or some tarnish on these people that live this lifestyle voluntarily, you know, and sacrifice so much for the betterment of all of the rest of us, it does hurt. Because it's like, you know, people just throw up their hands and, oh, yeah, another crooked cop, another dirty cop. And it's like, no, a crooked cop, a dirty cop. You know, don't say another because, you know, the taint of this one individual does not rub off on all of his brothers.
Yeah, you don't want to use that broad brush.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And, you know, go on. Is Cheryl with us?
Nope.
Oh, I thought that's what you were going to say. We got Cheryl.
Let's, you know, I want to tell you, if I might, about talking about police officers and what they face on a daily basis. Now, I never was in a shootout or anything, but I want to tell you the most scared I ever was I was working a midnight shift, graveyard shift, on Thanksgiving many years ago, and I was really having trouble staying awake. So I decided to run a little radar, and there was virtually even no traffic at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. But all of a sudden, this one car comes through, and I was watching a zone with a 35-mile speed limit and coming through at 75. So, of course, I kind of woke up and got alert, and the car was gaining speed as it's coming toward me. So I said, well, my first thought is maybe DWI, you know, that time of the morning and that speed. So anyway, it took me quite a while to catch up with the guy, or the driver, once he got by me. I finally pulled him over, and I got up to the car, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And it was a guy, it turned out, he was on his way to the hospital with his pregnant wife, and she was past due. And he tells me, you know, I was, when I first got to the car, I'm going through the license and registration routine, and then he says, we don't have time for that. He says, my wife's going to have a baby any second. I looked in, I could tell that obviously she was ready. So I didn't quite know quite what to do. And he says, you got two choices. He says, either escort us to the hospital or you're going to deliver the kid. Well, I'm going to tell you, I was never so scared in my life. I said, get in my car, we're going. So we got to the hospital. We made it in time, and in fact, they named the kid's middle name, they named after me, middle name of Dennis. So,
okay.
But that was quite a thing, but, you know, and again, that was a lighthearted moment, but you're right, when you walk up to that, the door of that car you stopped, or the door of the apartment where you've been dispatched to on a call, or the door of the business where the burglar alarm is activated or whatever. You never know for sure what you're going to get into. A lot of times it's what they call routine, but you just never know because each situation is a little different. And like you say, that one time might be the real deal, and it could be your last call.
And, you know, you make the best call you can in every circumstance, and that's why I'd like to extend, you know, the brotherhood of law enforcement, courtesy to my brothers in the police force by saying, you know what, oh, God, I wish you had done this. But you didn't, and I know you do the best that you can with the resources you have, and I know that you know, because even before this case we have together, you've walked into 100 courtrooms where no matter how good of a job you did, you're attacked, because that is what defense attorneys do, and I have plenty of friends that are defense attorneys. I'm not faulting them. They have a job to do. They're advocates. As a prosecutor, I'm an advocate as well. However, I do know that it's got to be really disheartening to live under the circumstances they live under on a day-to-day basis, to try and, especially somewhere like Detroit, to deal with an almost insurmountable crime, you know, problem with very little resources, to try and do the best you can, to be working with, you know, on fumes, eating fast food and drinking Coke, you know, and 18 hours later you may be able to go to bed for, you know, 6 hours, and then to walk into a courtroom and it's like, oh, the police officers, they didn't do A, B, C, and D. It's disheartening. And as a prosecutor, you know, many, many times I've been in the circumstances of trying to say to a jury, this is a diversion tactic. You know what? Yeah, maybe they should have done A, B, C, and D. Let's say they had done it perfectly. Would have it changed what we have here and bring them back to these are the facts? As
yes.
opposed to the red herring that the police didn't, you know, do what, you know, we all from watching CSI and Monday morning quarterbacking think they should have done.
And let me talk to you a little bit, too, Donna, about witnesses. For example, I think a lot of people aren't aware of this, that not every witness is a pristine witness, a saint. I mean, look at the cases where they get these jailhouse informants or they get the former mobsters that go in the witness protection program and become government witnesses. So I think, and maybe as a prosecutor, you've sometimes had a witness up there that you really weren't in love with as a human, you know, as a person. Maybe they had some baggage. But if they're a witness and they can, you know, you've screened them and interviewed them and they seem to have valid information, to make your case, you might have to use people like that. You don't get all priests and choir boys. Do you find that to be true?
Denny, let me tell you what. Especially having worked in Detroit, but even before that, having been the, you know, the queen of Pontiac, which is a suburb, well, it's a city and a suburb north of Detroit that, you know, has every bit as big of a crime problem as Detroit does. Getting a choir boy or a pristine witness rarely, if ever, happens. And for the most part, the witnesses that we get are, you know, every bit as bad as our victims. You know, I mean, people associate with persons that are, for lack of a better term, of their ilk. And, you know, when you come into a situation, I'll never forget a case I had in Detroit about 4 years ago where a group of kids, you know, school had just been released at the local high school, and a group of kids were walking towards an intersection and five cars pulled up from every direction and let loose and four kids were shot, one died. Even the three remaining survivors, by the time we got to trial, because of fear of retribution, it was a gang-related situation, not that three of the four victims even had any gang affiliation, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, you know, even the perfectly, you know, innocent victims who are not, connected in any way to the series of events that was going on that day, by the time the trial came around, you know, even up to the eve of trial, I prepped them and they were ready to go. And then the day of trial, you had gang members all over the courthouse and they became scared. And, you know, they all recanted their stories. You know, it was so darn crazy. Judges from all over the circuit were coming down to watch it. But that's not unusual. That is what prosecutors deal with on a daily basis. And over again, we have to tell juries. It's like, we don't go to central casting to get our witnesses. You know, you can't expect angels to be witnesses to crimes committed in hell. It doesn't work like that. So, yeah, it's a problem we deal with on a daily basis. And you couple, you know, the problem of having less than savory witnesses with juries that watch TV all the time and think that every case is like CSI. And, you know, as a prosecutor, that creates a world of trouble. It's like you have to go in saying, wait a minute, you're not going to like these people that I'm putting on the witness stand to prove this case to you. Oh, and by the way, I don't have any physical evidence. Oh, yeah, I know you all think I'm supposed to, but I don't. And, yeah, it causes a few sleepless nights, needless to say.
Good. So you do then think there is what they call the CSI effect? That some of us now, through these TV programs, are getting conditioned to think that every case should be provable beyond, not a reasonable doubt, but any doubt. It should be, you know, a DNA thing of, you know, 20 billion to one or whatever, that this is the guy or the guilty party, and expecting that amount of proof.
Denny, not only beyond any doubt, and I understand, I've been called for jury duty once, but needless to say, I was not picked. but that being, I'm sure the prosecutor would have wanted me, but as a prosecutor, you know that these things aren't like they're portrayed on TV, and because the juries these days are expecting them to be, over and over again, we're forced into the position of we have to put on what we call negative evidence. And what I mean by negative evidence is that we have to put witnesses on the stand. Let's say there's no fingerprints at a crime scene, which, by the way, is not all that unusual. I mean, there's a lot of things that factor into whether or not a fingerprint will be left behind. Everything from temperature, amount of secretion, you know, a person can be a secretor or a non-secretor, you know, so amount of moisture they have in their skin, you know, just the weather conditions, everything can affect that. But if I don't have fingerprints, the jury doesn't understand that that's more common than not. So I will bring in a fingerprint expert to say, under what circumstances do you get a fingerprint? Is it common not to have a fingerprint? If you don't have a fingerprint, does that mean no person was in there? And, you know, basically I'm putting on evidence of what I don't have, but it's to explain to the jury. And, you know, I tell them when I select a jury and I tell them an opening statement and I tell them again in closing argument, you know, this is not like CSI, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then through my witnesses, you know, now I got an expert up there who proves it to them. It's like, no, you know, you only get a fingerprint if you have A, B, C, D. You only get a fingerprint under these weather conditions, A, B, C, D. But at least that gives me the opportunity in closing argument to say, and just because there's not a fingerprint at the scene doesn't mean, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, as prosecutors, we now have to cover our bases and try and dissuade juries from all these beliefs that they've, you know, acquired, and, you know, all the things they think that you should have. Fortunately, I think prosecutors are getting better and better at it. I think they're understanding what jurors expect, and they're, for lack of a better word, indoctrinating them to understand. We even call it inoculating them. I mean, if there's something we don't have that's big in a case, I put it right out there in jury selection, and again, an opening statement. You're not going to hear A, B, C, and D, blah, 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 so that as they listen to the evidence, they understand, oh, that's not coming.
Yeah, that lessens, if you don't do it, then the defense can make an even bigger issue of it, right? Like, they were trying to hide the fact that they don't have this or don't have that.
Always rather have them hear it from me, Denny. I don't have this, and this is why.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, and this is a little older case now, but I haven't talked to you, I don't believe, since the verdict. What did you think of the Casey Anthony trial and verdict? Do you have any opinion on that as to what happened there?
You know what? I'm going to be very unpopular for saying this,
uh-huh.
but I had a lot of problems with the case from the get-go. Not that I don't think that the evidence strongly points at Casey Anthony, because I think it does. That being said, some of the things that they did in the case, you know, the smell, I don't know the technical word for it because I've certainly never used it, but, you know, the vapors from the trunk, the smell test that allegedly, you know, showed human decomposition, this and that. I mean, there were so many things that I felt that the prosecution was going out on a limb where when they got called on the carpet for it, they weren't able to respond adequately. And, you know, quite frankly, my rule of thumb has always been don't, you know, portray to the jury that you're grasping at straws. Because the minute the jury senses that, you're done. You are done. Even with, you know, I have tried, and I know tonight we were going to talk about cold case and maybe for a few minutes at the end you can throw it back to me and I'll put it out there, you know, about the Effie Hallman case and just talk a little bit about cold cases in general. But time and time again, I've overcome the hurdle of having cases that are 25-plus years old. I got to say, I think I've probably done 10 or 15 of them, maybe more. And, you know, I've done four cases that are 30 years old or older. I'm looking at a 40-year-old case right now. And it's the same sort of theory. It's like I always tell my police officers in these cases, you know, they want to try and go out there and you know, re-interview witnesses and stuff. And I'm like, you know what? Run your strategy by me. Because it's the same sort of thing. I don't want the jury, you know, if we ever get this to a trial, I don't want the jury to think that we were grabbing at straws and look bad. Let's go with what we got. Let's make the most of what we got. But before you decide on your own to go out and interview some person, which, by the way, I've had this situation occur in the Coral Watts serial murder case, they go out and re-interview a witness without ever showing them their statement of 30 years before. So now the person, you know, based on a 30-year later recollection, says, I saw A, B, C, and D, and the car color was wrong, and all sorts of things. But then when they were confronted with it, you know, if they had only refreshed their memories before, you know, making a new statement, they might have said, oh, yeah, it was a yellow car. Instead, they say, oh, it was a red car, blah, 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 and they get confronted with a discrepancy and they dig their heels in. So it's just like now you've just created a huge mountain for me out of what could have been a molehill in trial. So it's like minimal is better for me. I just don't like that picture that the police officers are heck-bent on getting a conviction. And, you know, whether it be in a cold case scenario or, you know, whatever, that they're grabbing at straws. So for me, it's like the less is better. Even though everybody thinks more is better, I think less is better. And, you know, it applies in, you know, the arena you're talking about, and it applies in cold cases, too.
Do you think that there was some criticism in the aftermath of that verdict in the Anthony case that, or speculation, that the prosecution overcharged it, and they shouldn't have gotten the death penalty involved, and they should have went maybe murder second or manslaughter, and that maybe the jury would have felt, well, you know, as long as it's a kind of a lesser charge, maybe we can go that route. Do you think it would have made a difference?
You know, once again, Denny, I guess we're back to shoulda, coulda, woulda. Bringing the death penalty into it, you know, I mean, I try never to fault police officers or prosecutors when it's not absolutely in your face that they were wrong. You know, the death of a child is a heinous thing. The, you know, premeditated death of a child so you can live a life of abandoned freedom and not be burdened down anymore, if that is what really happened, that's even a worse thing. Does that maybe deserve the death penalty? And I'm not going to go into all of the ramifications of the death penalty here. But I'm saying if there was ever a heinous crime deserving of severe punishment, it is the murder of an innocent child. And if the murder is predicated not only on someone having lost it, you know, a shaken baby type of case, or, you know, somebody who wasn't, you know, of the mental state that they were, you know, particularly, you know, ready to parent a child, and they lost it, and they, you know, beat a child or something. Don't get me wrong, I'm not making any excuses here. I'm just saying those types of crimes are easier to swallow than a crime where somebody says, this little baby is an inconvenience to my life and I want a party, and I'm going to research things on the internet and, you know, decide how best to get rid of the baby. I mean, you know, if that all happened that way, then yeah, that is a terrible crime. And, you know, prosecutors making charging decisions, they have to make them on the front end of the case. And, you know, you look at all the available evidence, and once again, I think prosecutors try to do the right thing. At that point in the game, they may have, you know, thought they were doing the right thing. That being said, as prosecutors, I think we also have to be very careful of the syndrome of, okay, now we've charged and we want victory at all costs. You know, I think every step of the way, a good, you know, prosecutor, a good, you know, servant of the public needs to evaluate evidence as it's coming in and make a very calculated decision. This is what we got. This is probably the best that, you know, we can get. And then make a decision. Even if you've already made a charging decision, you know, is this what we want to do in terms of moving forward? Rather than saying, we charged it, we're digging our heels in, and it's murder one or nothing. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know any of the decisions that went in to the charging decision or what happened after that as new evidence was coming in. I hope it was just all reviewed on a very calculated basis, because too often I've seen that that does not happen.
Okay, well, what we'll do, Don, I got two more things I'd like to run past you, and then we'll move on to the Alfie Hall case and some cold case discussion in general. First of all, do you have any comments or thoughts, or can you share them with us, about this Florida thing, this Trayvon Martin and the Mr. Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch guy?
You know what? Once again, Denny, I've been on a number of talk shows about this case, and what troubles me in this case is, well, there's a number of things that trouble me on both sides. What troubles me on the prosecution side is that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I should say on the law enforcement side, You know, it's like, oh, it was self-defense without any real critical analysis of the evidence being done. And then all of a sudden the special prosecutor comes in and it's like, this person has a very real difference of opinion with, you know, the prior police, you know, chief who had investigated the case. So it's like, okay, you know, and I'm not faulting her either. You know, based on the facts as I know them to date, you know, something's happened that, you know, the fact the 911 operator told him, you know, to back off and he forged forward. I mean, those are all things that are, you know, very, you know, real things that have to be looked at. But that being said, what has troubled me so much about this case is not only the rush to judgment, but the fact that it seems like, you know, the public outcry that preceded even any charging decision has seemed to influence a lot of decisions. It's like, you know what, people? We do have a system of justice in this country where you are innocent until proven guilty. And if he's guilty and 12 peers of his decide he's guilty, fine. But when you have daily news conferences calling for Mr. Zimmerman's head, at this point in the game, that is not our justice system either. And I have over and over again said, why doesn't everybody just back down and wait for a charging decision? Okay, we have it now. Let's wait for a jury of his peers to make a decision. If they make a decision that this was a guy who, you know, was anti-black, which I think anything but that has been shown to this point, was he a cop wannabe that was, you know, way too eager to engage? Maybe. But let's let a jury of his peers decide, and then you can have your news conferences and you can say that this shows, you know, racial profiling and this shows this and this shows that. But for gosh sakes, if anybody has any respect for our criminal justice system as it is supposed to operate, then let's just all back down right now. And, you know, rather than trying to influence a court of law because of what we think or what might have happened or what could have happened, and let's render our judgments after a jury does.
I'm with you on that. I think it needs to, like you say, stand down with all the rhetoric and go through the proper process and get to the truth and, you know, see where it leads. The other thing I wanted to ask you before we move on to the case is, now, as a prosecutor, you undoubtedly on occasion not have to, but deal with or talk to or interact with the families of murder victims. I suspect that some of them are more compelling perhaps than others, maybe depending on the situation, but how tough is it not to get a personal involvement or to, you know what I'm saying, to just strictly wear a prosecutor's hat and not an advocate hat? Is there a problem, or don't you need to do that? Is it okay to try to do both? How do you approach that type of situation?
You know, Denny, I always try. I mean, I've been over and over again been called out as being, you know, one of the victim's best friends and this and that. And, you know, as much as you would think, I mean, I sit on the board of Parents Murdered Children here in the Detroit area. As much as you would think I'd like that label, I don't, because I like to think that I'm a fair and impartial advocate. That being said, I am the people's lawyer. And, you know, to a certain extent, I have to involve myself with the family. But being very careful to make them understand that it's like, I am your lawyer. But that being said, you know, as a prosecutor, I have certain ethical obligations. And, you know, I try a case as an impartial advocate. But, you know, over and over again, you know, I've had to tell jurors and, you know, juries, I should say, you know, A, B, C, D, I represent, you know, the government and the victim in this case, to the extent that as an impartial advocate, I'm laying all the facts on the table. But I will tell you that, you know, and then I go into the emotional part of the argument, you know, this family lives on a daily basis where they wake up and they won't see their loved one anymore and blah, blah, blah. And obviously, you know, as an advocate, it gets a lot more personal than that. You know, people ask me on a daily basis, like, how do you keep it, you know, compartmentalized so that, you know, you don't go home and think about these people? And, you know, you only try to do that. It's like, I can't tell you how many times I've woken up in the middle of the night and it's like, oh my God, I have the weight of the world on my shoulder, because if I don't do a good enough argument, if I don't do, you know, a good enough opening or closing, or don't pull this off perfectly, it's my fault that, you know, that the trial goes down. But, you know, really early on I made, for lack of a better term, a deal with myself, and that was, as long as I can always look at myself in the mirror and say, you know, I've got people's lives in my hands, I did the absolute best that I could, I'll be okay. And on a daily basis, I basically say, you know what, I've done everything I could do. You know, if somebody can do it better than me after having, you know, 103 murder trials under my belt, go for it. You're welcome to try. But
give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go. Play ball.
Okay, Donna, now, we originally had hoped to have Cheryl McCollum on with us tonight. Cheryl's the director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, and she was going to be talking about a 1981 homicide that they're looking into, the research institute, of out of Atlanta, of a lady named Effie Hall, a single mother and college student at Clark Atlanta University. She was murdered January 20th, 1981. It is said she was found by a roommate with a gunshot wound to the chest, which exited from the back. At the time of her murder, Effie is reported to have had several roommates. However, only two of the roommate names are known at this time. One of her roommates had tried unsuccessfully to reach her by phone, returned to the apartment, and found Effie Hall dead on the floor with the telephone off the hook. So I'll throw it into your court, Donna, and get your impression on this case.
Well, you know what, a couple things here. You know, once again, 1981, we're talking a 31-year-old murder case. That being said, you know, especially in the arena I've operated in the last 10 years or so, which is predominantly cold cases, there's always hope. I mean, cases I never dreamed would be solved, you know, Coral Watts, the serial murder case that I prosecuted, or I should say one of them, is, you know, a typical example. It's like, you know, 28 years later, the tip fell out of the sky. You know, a person who might have seen a murder in Ferndale, Michigan, and we went back, reconstructed the file, and I'll be darned if I didn't have Joe Foy, you know, who came forward and said, yeah, I saw a murder in that alley 30 years ago. I drew a composite sketch. Of course, you know, Murphy's Law, the file had been lost in the local police department. But Detroit Police Department had done a task force on this serial murderer. Long, long story that, you know, it would take two programs to cover. But that being said, we reconstructed the file. The woman who drew the crimes or the composite sketch of the defendant still worked at the Oakland County Sheriff's Department. She had the original sketch in her basement in a box, and I'll be darned if we didn't reconstruct the whole darn file, and we convicted him. So
wow.
It's just one example. Like I said, I wish we had more time to talk about that. Maybe sometime we can devote an hour to that case alone, because that was the most fantastic series of events, and they're actually the reason that's at the forefront of my mind is Investigation Discovery is up here in Michigan right now taping for a show on that case, so it's kind of at the forefront. But the bottom line is that's only one example. You know, like I said, I've had a number of cases in, you know, a good handful that are 30 years old, and I'll be darned if we haven't solved them, you know, with good cold case squads, and not only solved them, but, you know, brought them through a successful prosecution. So I guess the bottom line is there's always hope.
I was going to say, so, of course, we get a lot of the guests we have on the show are survivors, and they get very frustrated, obviously, when, you know, there hasn't been an arrest or a conviction, that type of thing, and the murder of their loved one. And I always try to tell them, look, there's nothing cast in stone that said if a case isn't solved within 3 years or 5 years or 8 years that it goes in the garbage can. It's possible to solve these cases, like you were saying, 20, 30, maybe 40 years down the road. It's not going to happen in every one, but the age of the case itself doesn't automatically rule out the possibility of a resolution.
Well, you know, Denny, conventional wisdom really pertaining to homicide cases is that, and probably rightfully so, but that, you know, time and speed are of the essence. That all being said, identifying and interviewing witnesses while the crime is fresh is important. And, you know, the first 48 to 72 hours are critical. However, there are things that come into play with cold cases that don't come into play with, you know, fairly recent homicides. I mean, just, you know, the normal passage of time alone, it causes relationships and associations to change.
Yes.
You know, and changes in relationships are vital to cold cases because witnesses may now be more willing to provide information. Yesterday's doper may have matured, married, found religion, or, you know, changed
Donna, can you
life.
Hold us all? We got a caller on the line. Let me just see. Maybe it's even Cheryl.
Right.
I'll be get back
right.
to that in just
Let's
a second.
Hi.
Hey, caller. Hello. From area code 404, you're on the line.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank
Good.
You.
Hey, my name is Michael Griffin, and I'm a friend of Cheryl McCollum. Unfortunately, she's not on the show tonight. However, you guys are discussing a case for Effie Hall, and that's my mother. I'm 37 years old tonight, and I was 7 years old when my mother was murdered. I'm sorry. We were living in Florida, and my mother moved to Atlanta. Long story short, she was killed, and 31 years later, I decided to look at the file. I took a look at my mother's file. I saw pictures of her laying in the prone position. She was dead. And I read the police report, and I read the witness statements, and that created a burning desire inside of me to find justice for my mother as well as, you know, help my grandmother. So I reached out to a couple of different outlets. Number one was Clark Atlanta. There was also the local radio station. And then I finally found Cheryl McCollum. And she and a team of students here at a local college in Atlanta have really spearheaded a campaign to where they're on the radio with you guys tonight. And I would have never imagined this would come to fruition. But we're utilizing a social media campaign with the hopes of solving my mother's murder case. So I'm just calling to say, you know, anything that you guys can do to help us, the family really appreciates it.
Well, thank you very much for the call, first of all. And do you have any questions, Donna?
Really, no questions. I'm sorry, you said Donna. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, no, I don't have any questions. What I want to say, though, is that sometimes that media campaign is the key. I'll tell you, serial murderer Coral Watts, but for the Attorney General of Michigan, Mike Cox, going on a TV show, the Dan Abrams show, and saying Coral Watts is about to be released in Texas due to a long chain of circumstances. But anyway, we have reason to believe he committed many, many murders up here in Michigan. Does anybody have any evidence? And I'll be darned if the next day I didn't come home, or I should say I didn't come into the office to find a pink message slip, Joseph Foy, Ferndale, Michigan, saw one of Coral Watts' murders. You know, I even looked at my secretary and said, wacko? And she said, I don't think so. That's only one example. I had another case in Holland, Michigan, a 30-year-old murder where a woman, one of the most terrific crimes you can ever imagine, it's been covered on Dateline, but a woman was brutally gang raped by a number of friends. And the only way that case came to the forefront is that a group of students at the local college did a documentary film, Who Killed Janet Chandler? It stoked enough interest that the Michigan State Police and the Holland Police got together and formed a task force, and it took them 2 years, but they solved the case after 30 years. So those media campaigns are very important, getting word out, because there are people that know what happened to your mother. And getting the word out is sometimes the first step.
Well, you know, I appreciate the information. And, you know, obviously I'm blown away, and there aren't really words that I can say right now that can express how I feel. Again, you know, I was shielded from this as a child. And, you know, I've lived in Atlanta since 1992 off and on. And, you know, just on a whim about, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, I decided to reopen my mother's murder case. And, you know, it got to the point where I'm speaking to you tonight. So I'm ever so gracious. And we'll see where we go, you know, from here.
One
well, I'd like to, you know, sometimes, certainly, I don't, you know, something obviously came up for Cheryl tonight. But anytime... Cheryl would like to get on the air, and you'd be welcome to join her. We certainly could do, you know, the program that we'd originally planned to do tonight. We can schedule that for a future time and get more information out there because, as Donna was saying, getting the word out and getting some exposure is key because somebody out there somewhere somehow knows what happened to your mom. And if we can get, Cheryl and you and we can get the word out, there's a chance that we're going to reach that person or reach someone who can reach that person and maybe get some answers and get the case moving forward.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. I'm going to let you guys go, and obviously I can probably communicate with you guys eventually through Shell, but thank you guys for taking the time to talk about my mother tonight, and, you know, it's really a blessing just to kind of listen to you guys say her name.
Well, thank you very much for the call, and you said it was your birthday?
No, it's just my mother, and it's not my birthday. My birthday is December 1st, but otherwise I saw where Shell had done some marketing for this, and I just wanted to pay attention and tell you guys, so thank you for, you know, mentioning her name tonight.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling in, and let's plan in the future to do a full program on it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good night. Now, that's nice. You know, this young man was shielded for all that time, Donna, and then finally decided to take a look at that file and, you know, and reached out to Cheryl McCollum and her folks, and that's, you know, a great thing. After all these years, to have some hope that, you know, that maybe there can be some resolution in this.
You know, and Denny, I really, you know, believe that, you know, sometimes the conjunction of the stars is right, and it's time for a case to be solved. It happened in Coral Watts. It happened in the case I was just discussing, you know, the terrible gang rape of that woman where the students decided to do the story. It's like, you know, sometimes it's just time for a case to be solved. And, you know, the cases that as a prosecutor I have been firmly convinced will never be solved, sometimes all of a sudden, you know, it's right in front of you, it is solved, or at least you have a prosecutable case. And then you look back later and say, I just can't even believe the stars aligned as they did. But I've seen it happen over and over again. And, you know, I'm a believer. Getting the word out is critical, it's key, and it does result in very real convictions many, many years later.
Donna, do you think, obviously I think as a prosecutor, you'd like, you know, whether the homicide happened yesterday or 30 years ago, would like to get it solved. But is there any special satisfaction perhaps when you do have a cold case where maybe the family's kind of given up hope and so forth, to be able to get an arrest and conviction in cases that are years or decades old? Is there a little extra charge in that, maybe, you know, a little extra emotion?
You know, no question about it, Denny. And over again, we all do it as prosecutors, but I recycle a theme, and not in every old cold case, but many times, because I think it's a powerful theme. It is, you know, screams boxed up and bottled up and boxes sitting on a shelf year after year after year, just waiting to escape. And, you know, knowing that someday somebody would take the time to, you know, take a new set of eyes on that box and let those screams that have been bottled up for so long out. And, you know, over and over again in these older cases, jurors have come up to me and said, oh, my God, I kept thinking about those screams, you know, boxed up on a shelf, gathering dust in a police department. You know, there were screams in those boxes, and there were and there are.
Final question, what do you think, I know that some departments and agencies are having issues financially with their budgets, and I understand that some are cutting cold case squads because they don't have the luxury anymore of having people just working cold cases and so on. And I know that some are now taking on volunteers, like retired cops and stuff to work, or retired investigators to work on a volunteer basis. What is your thought on if during the financial crunch of having perhaps volunteer cold case squads, you know, if you screen the people and they have the expertise or experience of letting volunteers try to give a hand?
Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. As long as they're being screened and they're doing it for the right reasons, I'll take any retired Detroit cop that I know from the homicide unit or from the major crimes case or major crimes team. Or, you know, we have a guy in Detroit here, Tom Berry, who's on a lot of local TV shows. He's always was one of the top guys that would come in a really violent, you know, murder or some other case. You bring a Tom Berry in as a volunteer in a, you know, in a cold case squad that I'm working with, oh, my God, I died and went to heaven. Yeah, love the idea, as long as you got the right people doing it for the right reasons.
Okay, Donna, we're just about out of time. Please, when you get a chance, would you send me the information on that case you were talking about? Maybe we can put together a show on that case.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll see what we can do there. I want to thank you very much for coming on tonight and sharing all your insights with us.
Always glad to do it, Denny.
I also want to thank the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImagenePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, May 15th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always appreciate, we always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire, all one word, @gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. turn on the volume on your computer, and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night now. Good night, everyone.